Hello, today is February 19th, 2026. My name is Dorothy, and I'll be reading an Associated Press article from World News. The title, Andrew Mountbatten, Windsor, arrested on suspicion of misconduct in public office over ties to Epstein, by Donica Kirker, updated February 19th, 2026, London. Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, the former British prince who was stripped of his royal titles because of his links to convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, was arrested Thursday on suspicion of misconduct in public office. While Andrew has consistently denied any wrongdoing in connection with his friendship with Epstein, concerns about Mountbatten Windsor's links to the latest financier have dogged the royal family for more than a decade. But the arrest of a brother of a monarch was an extraordinary development with no precedent in modern times that will no doubt put more pressure on the crown. After the arrest, King Charles III said that the law must take its course in the investigation, and he sought to reassure the British public that he would continue to serve them. Thames Valley Police said that a man in his 60s from Norfolk in eastern England was arrested and remained in custody. The force, which covers areas west of London, including Mountbatten Windsor's former home, did not identify the suspect in line with standard procedures in Britain, but pointed to its statement when asked to confirm if Andrew was arrested. Mountbatten Windsor, who turned 66 on Thursday, moved to Charles' estate in Norfolk after he was evicted from his longtime home near Windsor Castle earlier this month. Police are looking at whether Andrew sent confidential reports to Epstein. Thames Valley Police previously said it was assessing reports that Mountbatten Windsor sent confidential trade reports to Epstein in 2010 when the former prince was Britain's special envoy for international trade. Those reports stemmed from correspondence between the two men that was among the millions of pages of documents from the U.S. Department's investigation into Epstein that were released last month. Following a thorough assessment, we have now opened an investigation into this allegation of misconduct in public office, Assistant Chief Constable Oliver Wright said in a statement. We understand the significant public interest in this case, and we will provide updates at the appropriate time. Police also said they were searching two properties. The arrest came after pictures circulated online that appeared to show unmarked police cars at Wood Farm, Mountbatten Windsor's home on the Sandringham Estate in Norfolk, with plainclothes officers gathering outside. The allegations begin being investigated Thursday are separate from those made by Virginia Guffrey, who claimed she had been trafficked to Britain to have sex with Andrew in 2001 when she was just 17. Guffrey died by suicide last year. Still, Guffrey's family praised the arrest, saying, "Today, our broken hearts have been lifted at the news that no one is above the law, not even royalty." The family added, "He was never a prince. For survivors everywhere, Virginia did this for you." A spectacular fall from grace. This is the most spectacular fall from grace for a member of the royal family in modern times, said Craig Prescott, a royal expert at Royal Holloway, University of London. The last time a senior British royal was arrested was almost 400 years ago, during the reign of King Charles I, that saw a growing power struggle between the crown and Parliament. After the king attempted to arrest lawmakers in the House of Commons in 1642, hostilities erupted in the English Civil War, which ended with victory for the parliamentary forces of Oliver Cromwell. Charles was arrested, tried, convicted of high treason, and beheaded in 1649. King Charles III says the investigation into Andrew must take its course. The late Queen Elizabeth II forced Mountbatten Windsor to give up royal duties and end his charitable work in 2019 after he tried to explain away his ties to Epstein during a catastrophic interview with the BBC. But more details about the relationship emerged in a book published last year, and Charles stripped him of the right to be called a prince and ordered him to move. Then came the unprecedented announcement last week that Buckingham Palace was ready to cooperate in the event of a police inquiry into Mountbatten Windsor's link to Epstein. Charles was forced to act after the U.S. Justice Department released millions of pages of Epstein documents that revealed the extent of his relationship with Mountbatten Windsor and showed that their guilty correspondence continued long after Epstein pleaded guilty in 2008 to soliciting a minor for prostitution. Epstein was arrested on sex trafficking charges brought by federal prosecutors in New York in 2019. He took his own life in jail while awaiting trial. After Thursday's arrest, Charles issued a statement to reiterate that he would cooperate with the investigation. "Let me state clearly, the law must take its course," the king said. "As this process continues, it would not be right for me to comment further on this matter." He addressed the British public, saying, "My family and I will continue in our duty and service to you all." He signed the statement, "Charles R., in line with the convention that British monarchs use to sign their names, with the R standing for Rex, Latin for king. It's unclear how long Andrew will be held." Policing commentator Danny Shaw told the BBC that in most cases, suspects are held between 12 and 24 hours and are then either charged or released pending further investigation. The absolute longest the former prince can be held for is 96 hours, but this would require multiple extensions from senior police officers and a magistrate's court. It is unclear what time Andrew was arrested. Andrew will be placed in a cell in a custody suite with just a bed and a toilet, where he will wait until his police interview. There will be no special treatment for him, Shaw said. Hello. Today is February 19th, 2026. My name is Dorothy, and I will be reading an Associated Press article from World News. The title, Russia hosts Cuban foreign minister and urges U.S. not to blockade Cuba. Updated February 18, 2026. Moscow. Russian top officials hosted the Cuban foreign minister for talks in Moscow on Wednesday and spoke out in support of the island nation as it faces blackouts and severe fuel shortages worsened by a U.S. oil embargo. Cuban Foreign Minister Bruno Rodriguez met with his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov and later in the day with President Vladimir Putin. Lavrov urged the U.S. to refrain from blockading Cuba, which has struggled to import oil for its power plants and refineries after U.S. President Donald Trump threatened any nation that sold oil to Cuba with tariffs. Together with most members of the global community, we are calling on the U.S. to show common sense, take a responsible approach, and refrain from its plans of sea blockade, Lavrov said during the talks with Rodriguez. He promised that Moscow will continue supporting Cuba and its people in protecting the country's sovereignty and security. In his meeting with Rodriguez, Putin said of the restrictions, "You know how we feel about this. We don't accept anything of the sort. We have always been on Cuba's side in its struggle for independence, for the right to chart its own path of development, and we have always supported the Cuban people," Putin said. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov earlier on Wednesday, noted that Russia, like many other countries, has consistently spoken against the blockade of the island. "We have our relations with Cuba, and we value these relations very much," Peskov told reporters. "And we intend to further develop them, of course, during difficult times, by providing appropriate assistance to our friends." Asked whether sending fuel to Cuba could derail a recent warming of ties with Washington, Peskov responded that "we don't think these issues are linked." Putin has praised Trump's efforts to mediate an end to the conflict in Ukraine, and Moscow and Washington have discussed ways to revive their economic ties. Venezuela, one of Cuba's main oil suppliers, stopped selling crude to the island in January after the U.S. captured then-President Nicolas Maduro in a pre-dawn raid and flew him to New York to face drug trafficking charges. Mexico also cut off oil shipments to Cuba in January after Trump issued the tariff threat. Russia's Avestia news outlet last week cited the Russian embassy in Havana as saying that Moscow was preparing to send humanitarian fuel shipment to Havana in the near future. On Monday, Russian ambassador to Cuba, Victor Coronelli, said that Moscow was looking into details of organizing assistance to Cuba, but offered no specifics. Cuba's fuel shortages already have forced Russian tourist companies to halt the sales of package tours to the island after the Cuban government said that it will not provide fuel to planes that land on the island. Hello. Today is February 19th, 2026. My name is Dorothy, and I'll be reading an Associated Press article from U.S. News Politics. Tariffs paid by mid-sized U.S. firms tripled last year, new analysis from J.P. Morgan Chase Institute shows, by Josh Boak, updated February 19, 2026. Washington. Tariffs paid by mid-sized U.S. businesses tripled over the course of last year. New research tied to one of America's leading banks showed on Thursday more evidence that President Donald Trump's push to charge higher taxes on imports is causing economic disruption. The additional taxes have meant that companies that employ a combined 48 million people in the U.S., the kinds of businesses that Trump had promised to revive, have had to find ways to absorb the new expense by passing it along to customers in the form of higher prices, employing fewer workers, or accepting lower profits. That's a big change in their cost of doing business, said Chi Mack, business research director of the J.P. Morgan Chase Institute, which published the analysis on Thursday. We also see some indications that they may be shifting away from transacting with China and maybe towards some other regions in Asia. The research doesn't say how the additional costs are flowing through the economy, but it indicates that tariffs are being paid by U.S. firms. It's part of a growing body of economic analyses that counter the administration's claims that foreigners pay the tariffs. The J.P. Morgan Chase Institute report used payments data to look at businesses that might lack the pricing power of large multinational companies to offset tariffs, but may be small enough to quickly change supply chains to minimize exposure to the tax increases. The companies tended to have revenues between $10 million and $1 billion, with fewer than 500 employees, a category known as middle market. The analysis suggests that the Trump administration's goal of becoming less directly reliant on Chinese manufacturers has been occurring. Payments to China by these companies were 20% below their October 2024 levels, but it's unclear whether that means China is simply routing its goods through other countries or if supply chains have moved. The authors of the analysis emphasized in an interview that companies are still adjusting to the tariffs and said they plan to continue studying the issue. The White House did not immediately respond to questions about the analysis, which showed that U.S. companies are paying tariffs that the president had previously claimed would be paid by foreign entities. Trump imposed a series of tariffs last year for the ostensible goal of reducing the U.S. trade imbalance with other countries, so that America was no longer importing more than it exports. But trade data published Thursday by the Census Bureau showed that the trade deficit climbed last year by $25.5 billion to $1.24 trillion. The president on Wednesday posted on social media that he expected there would be a trade surplus during this year. The Trump administration has been adamant that the tariffs are a boon for the economy, businesses, and workers. Kevin Hassett, director of the White House National Economic Council, lashed out on Wednesday at research by the New York Federal Reserve, showing that nearly 90% of the burden for Trump's tariffs fell on U.S. companies and consumers. "The paper is an embarrassment," Hassett told CNBC. "It's, I think, the worst paper I've ever seen in the history of the Federal Reserve System. The people associated with this paper should presumably be disciplined." Trump increased the average tariff rate to 13% from 2.6% last year, according to the New York Fed researchers. He declared that tariffs on some items like steel, kitchen cabinets, and bathroom vanities were in the national security interest of the country, and he declared an economic emergency to bypass Congress and impose a baseline tax on goods for much of the world last April at an event he called Liberation Day. The high rates provoked a financial market panic, prompting Trump to walk back his rates and then engage in talks with multiple countries that led to a set of new trade frameworks. The Supreme Court is expected to rule soon on whether Trump surpassed his legal authority by declaring an economic emergency. Trump was elected in 2024 on his promise to tame inflation, but his tariffs have contributed to voter frustration over affordability. While inflation has not spiked during Trump's term thus far, hiring slowed sharply, and a team of academic economists estimate that consumer prices were roughly 0.8 percentage points higher than they would otherwise be. Hello, today's February 19th, 2026. My name is Dorothy, and I'll be reading an Associated Press article from Business News. The title, "Most U.S. Stocks Are Falling, Though Gains for Walmart and Deere Limit the Damage," by Stan Cho. Updated 11-10 February 19, 2026, New York. The majority of U.S. stocks are falling on Thursday, but gains for Walmart, Deere, and other companies are helping to limit the damage. The S&P 500 slipped 0.2% and was potentially heading for its first loss in 4 days. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was down 141 points, or 0.3%, as of 11 a.m. Eastern Time. And the NASDAQ Composite was 0.1% lower. Booking Holdings dropped 7.6% for one of the market's sharpest losses, even though the company behind the Booking.com, Priceline, and OpenTable brands reported a profit for the latest quarter that edged past analysts' expectations. Its stock has been under pressure because of worries that competitors powered by artificial intelligence technology could upend its industry and take away customers at some point. It's lost more than a quarter of its value so far this year already. Such worries have been rolling through the U.S. stock market recently, hitting industries as far-flung as software and legal services and trucking logistics. Investors have so suddenly and aggressively been punishing stocks of companies seen as under threat by AI that analysts have likened it to a shoot first, ask questions later mentality. Kavana sank 6.6%, despite also reporting a stronger profit for the latest quarter than analysts expected. Investors may have been paying more attention to how much profit the auto retailer made before vehicles sold, which was lower than expected. The majority of stocks across Wall Street fell, but Walmart helped to keep the market in check. The retail giant sold rose 1.5% after delivering stronger results for the latest quarter than analysts expected, though it gave a profit forecast for the upcoming year that fell short of estimates. Deere was also strong and jumped 11.5% after the machinery maker reported a higher profit than analysts expected. CEO John May said it's seeing a continued recovery in demand from construction and smaller agricultural customers, though its global large agricultural customers are still feeling pressure. The biggest gains in the S&P 500 came from stocks of oil companies, which climbed with the price of crude. A barrel of benchmark U.S. crude added 2.2% to $66.49, while Brent crude climbed 1.8% to $71.63. Worries are rising again about a possible military confrontation between the United States and Iran. President Donald Trump has been raising the pressure on Iran, which is home to some of the world's largest oil reserves, because of its disputed nuclear program. If a conflict were to break out, it could constrict the global flow of oil. Occidental Petroleum jumped 8.8% after it also reported a stronger profit for the latest quarter than analysts expected. In the bond market, Treasury yields held relatively steady after a report said the number of U.S. workers applying for unemployment benefits eased last week. That could be a signal that the pace of layoffs is slowing. A solid job market, in turn, could keep the Federal Reserve on hold for longer before it resumes its cuts to interest rates. Fed officials said at their last meeting that they want to see inflation fall further before they would support cutting rates further this year. If oil prices keep rising, that would push upward on inflation. The yield on the 10-year Treasury edged down to 4.08% from 4.09% late Wednesday. Other U.S. economic reports said that growth for manufacturing in the Mid-Atlantic region is accelerating, but potential home buyers across the country didn't sign as many contracts in January to purchase. The U.S. trade deficit also widened in December by more than economists expected. In stock markets abroad, indexes fell in Europe following better performances in Asia. South Korea's KOSPI jumped 3.1% as trading resumed following a Lunar New Year holiday. Markets in Hong Kong and Shanghai remained closed. Hello, today is February 19th, 2026. My name is Dorothy, and I will be reading an Associated Press article from their fact check section. The title, A Look at False Claims Made by the Trump Administration as It Revokes a Key Scientific Finding, by Melissa Golden, updated February 13, 2026. President Donald Trump on Thursday revoked the 2009 endangerment finding, which has long been the central basis for U.S. action to regulate greenhouse gas emissions and fight climate change. But in making the announcement, Trump and Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Lee Zeldin made false claims regarding the government declaration, climate change, and energy. Here's a closer look at the facts. Trump, known as the endangerment finding, this determination had no basis in fact, had none whatsoever, and it had no basis in law. The facts, this is false. The endangerment finding was adopted in 2009 by the EPA after the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in 2007 that greenhouse gases are air pollutants that can be regulated under the Clean Air Act. Quote, the idea that the endangerment finding has no basis in law is ludicrous, said Ann Carlson, a professor of environmental law at the University of California, Los Angeles. The Supreme Court in Massachusetts versus EPA specifically directed the Environmental Protection Agency to determine whether greenhouse gases endanger public health and welfare. The endangerment finding is the result. Scientific evidence to support the endangerment finding was provided by the EPA at the time of its inception and is still available on the agency's website today. Multiple federal courts have upheld the endangerment finding since it was adopted 16 years ago. Trump, We've basically stopped all windmills in this country. It's the most expensive energy you can get. The facts. Onshore wind is one of the cheapest sources of electricity generation, with new wind farms expected to produce around 30 per megawatt hour, according to July estimates from the Energy Information Administration. This compares to a new natural gas plant, around $65 per megawatt hour, or a new advanced nuclear reactor, which runs over $80. Offshore wind is among the sources of new power generation that will cost the most to build and operate at $88 per megawatt hour, the EIA said in July. Trump asked about the cost to health and the environment. It has nothing to do with public health. This is all a scam, a giant scam. This was a ripoff of the country by Obama and Biden. And let's say Obama started it and got it rolling, and a terrible ripoff. The facts. Thousands of peer-reviewed scientific studies connect health harms to climate change. They find increasing deaths from heat waves, extreme weather such as hurricanes and floods, and air pollution from worsening wildfires. A 2021 study in Nature Climate Change calculated that globally about 9,700 people die a year from heat-related deaths attributable to human-caused climate change based on data from 732 cities, including more than 200 in the United States. A separate study last year listed dozens of climate change health harms and concluded, using the EPA's own calculation method, that the health costs are at least $10 billion a year, probably much more. The science of climate change dates back nearly 170 years to studies done by American Eunice Foote showing that carbon dioxide heated cylinders with thermometers inside more than ambient air. The first national climate assessment done in 2000 before Obama and Biden concluded that climate variability and change are likely to increase morbidity and mortality risks. Zeldin, the Obama and Biden administrations used the endangerment finding to steamroll into existence a left-wing wish, including electric vehicle mandates. The facts. Trump has made this claim. There was no federal mandate to force the purchase of EVs. If you looked at some of the tables that were in the Biden rules, you could see that there were a variety of different ways that companies could comply with the standards, said Carrie Jenks, the executive director of Harvard Law School's Environmental and Energy Law Program. The endangerment finding nor the regulations mandated a shift from one type of vehicle to another. Former President Joe Biden did set up a non-binding goal that EVs make up half of new cars sold by 2030. Trump issued an executive order on his first day in office, revoking that goal. Biden's policies tightened restrictions on pollution from gas-powered cars and trucks in an effort to encourage Americans to buy EVs and car companies to shift from gas-powered vehicles to electric cars. Hello, today is February 19th, 2026. My name is Dorothy, and I'll be reading an Associated Press article from Politics. The title, U.S. Senators Visit Key Ukrainian Port City as They Push for Fresh Sanctions on Russia, by Stephen Groves, updated February 18th, 2026. Washington. A delegation of U.S. senators was returning Wednesday from a trip to Ukraine, hoping to spur action in Congress for a series of sanctions meant to economically cripple Moscow and pressure President Vladimir Putin to make key concessions in peace talks. It was the first time U.S. senators have visited Odessa, Ukraine's third most populous city, and an economically crucial Black Sea port that has been particularly targeted by Russia since the war began nearly 4 years ago. Democratic Senators Jeanne Shaheen, Chris Coons, Richard Blumenthal, and Sheldon Whitehouse made the trip. Republican Senator Tom Tillis had planned to join, but was unable to for personal reasons. One of the things we heard wherever we stopped today was that the people of Ukraine want a peace deal, but they want a peace deal that preserves their sovereignty, that recognizes the importance of the integrity of Ukraine, Shaheen said on a phone call with reporters. The visit and the push for Congress to take up sanctions on Russia come at a crucial moment in the conflict. Delegations for the two sides were also meeting in Switzerland for 2 days of U.S. brokered talks, but neither side appeared ready to budge on key issues like territory and future security guarantees. The sanctions, senators hoped, could prod Putin towards settling for peace, as the U.S. has set a June deadline for settlement. Literally, nobody believes that Russia is acting in good faith in the negotiations with our government and with the Ukrainians, White House said, and so pressure becomes the key. Still, legislation to impose tough sanctions on Russia has been on hold in Congress for months. Senators have put forward a range of sanction measures, including one sweeping bill that would allow the Trump administration to impose tariffs and secondary sanctions on countries that purchase Russia's oil, gas, uranium, and other exports, which are crucial to financing Russia's military. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee has also advanced a series of more targeted bills that would sanction China's efforts to support Russia's military, commandeer frozen Russian assets, and go after what's known as Moscow's shadow fleet of oil tankers being used to circumvent sanctions already in place. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, who has co-sponsored the Senate sweeping sanctions and tariff legislation, also released a statement during the Munich Security Conference this weekend, saying that Senate Majority Leader John Thune had committed to bringing up the sanctions bill once it clearly has the 60 votes needed to move through the Senate. "This legislation will be a game changer," Graham said. "President Trump has embraced it. It is time to vote." Blumenthal, who co-sponsored the bill alongside Graham, also said there is bipartisan support for the legislation, which he called a very tough sledgehammer of sanctions and tariffs. But he also noted that we need to work out some of the remaining details. Democrats and a handful of Republicans have been opposed to President Donald Trump's campaign to impose tariffs around the world in an effort to strike trade deals and spur more manufacturing in the U.S. In the House, Democrats are opposed to the tariff provisions of that bill. Instead, a bipartisan group of lawmakers, led by Republican Representative Brian Fitzpatrick, has proposed separate legislation that makes it more difficult for Trump to waive sanctions, but does away with the tariff provisions. A separate bill led by the top Democrat on the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Representative Gregory Meeks, would bolster U.S. military support for Ukraine by $8 billion. Democrats currently need one more Republican to support an effort to force a vote on that bill. Once they return to the U.S., the senators said they would detail how U.S. businesses based in Ukraine have been attacked by Russia. The Democrats are also hoping to build pressure on Trump to send more U.S. weapons to Ukraine. "Putin understands weapons, not words," Blumenthal said. Still, the lawmakers will soon return to a Washington where the Trump administration is ambivalent about its long-term commitments to securing peace in Ukraine as well as Europe. For now, at least, they were buoyed by the conversations from their European counterparts and Republican colleagues. "We and the Republican senators who were with us in Munich spoke with one voice about our determination to continue to support Ukraine," Coons said. Hello, today's February 19th, 2026. My name is Dorothy, and I'll be reading an Associated Press article from Sports News. The title, Alyssa Liu carries U.S. hopes into the women's free skate final at the Milan Cortina Olympics, by Dave Scretta, updated February 19, 2026. Alyssa Liu is left to bear the ambitions of the American figure skating team on Thursday night when the last of the Blade Angels, with a legitimate shot at the Olympic gold medal, tries to catch Japanese teammates Ami Naki and Kaori Sakamoto during the women's free skate at the Milan Cortina Games. Naki, Sakamoto, and Mon Chiba give Japan the chance for the first ever women's podium sweep. Then there is Adelia Petrosian, the young Russian sprite, competing as a neutral athlete and the only one of the contenders who has the ability to land a quad jump. She could shake up the entire competition with one big performance. Those are the key players as the final night of figure skating drama unfolds at the Winter Games. Of course I want a medal. It would be very nice, said Sakamoto, the bronze medalist from the 2022 Beijing Games, who trails Naki by just a point in what is likely her final Olympics. But I want to let everybody know what I've done over my career. I want people to know that there was a skater of this kind in Japan who had performed for a long period. Indeed, the Olympic gold medal is just about the only thing the 25-year-old Sakamoto has yet to win in her career. At the opposite end of the longevity spectrum is Naki, the 17-year-old inspired by the great Mayo Asada. She will be the final skater on the ice after a brilliant performance Tuesday night when she landed one of two triple axels in the entire women's short program. Chiba trails both of her Japanese teammates along with Liu, but the world bronze medalist is firmly in the mix. Being in Italy with the music Romeo and Juliet, I hope to skate as well as possible, Chiba said, and see how things are. Liu, who is 2 points out of first place, was the only skater to wedge herself among the Japanese trio. The 20-year-old from the San Francisco Bay Area has been on a dream ride ever since her 2-year retirement, which had allowed her to reprioritize the things in her life and rediscover her love for skating. Liu became the first American world champion since Kimmy Meisner in 2006, last year in Boston, and now she could end an even longer U.S. drought for women at the Olympics. The Star-Spangled Banner has not played for a podium ceremony since Sarah Hughes triumphed at the 2002 Salt Lake City Games. I don't think about stuff like that, said the carefree Liu, who finished sixth at the Beijing Games shortly before walking away from the sport. My goal is just to do my program and share my story. Petrosian is the wild card in the competition simply because she is so largely unknown. The 18-year-old from Moscow has been unable to compete on a global stage because Russia remains banned from international events following its invasion of Ukraine. The few glimpses that people have seen have come from domestic events where scores are typically inflated and where the competition is far different from what Petrosian is experiencing at the Olympics. Yet the latest pupil of controversial coach Ateri Tutabezi, Petrosian has proven in Milan that she could well become her nation's next gold medalist, following in the footsteps of compatriots Adelina Sotnikova, Alina Sagatova, and Anna Shakabova. The last non-Russian to win the Olympic gold medal was South Korea's Una Kim at the 2010 Vancouver Games. At first I was worried, not about my skate, but about my emotional state. This was the most important start of my life, Petrosian said, following her short program Tuesday night. I hope this will help me with my free skate. Hello, today's February 19th, 2026. My name is Dorothy, and I'll be reading an Associated Press article from their health section. The title, FDA will drop two-study requirement for new drug approvals, aiming to speed access, by Matthew Perrone. updated February 18, 2026, Washington. The Food and Drug Administration plans to drop its longtime standard of requiring 2 rigorous studies to win approval for new drugs. The latest change from Trump administration officials vowing to speed up the availability of certain medical products. Going forward, the FDA's default position will be to require 1 study for new drugs and other novel health products, FDA Commissioner Dr. Marty Makary and a top deputy, Dr. Vinay Prasad, wrote in a New England Journal of Medicine piece published Wednesday. The announcement is the latest example of Makary and his team changing long-standing FDA standards and procedures with the stated goal of slashing bureaucracy and accelerating the availability of new medicines. Since arriving at the agency last April, Makary has launched a series of directives that he says will shorten FDA reviews, including mandating the use of artificial intelligence by staffers and offering 1-month drug assessments for new medications that serve national interests. It contrasts with the FDA's more restrictive approach to other products, including vaccines. In their piece published Wednesday, Makary and Prasad state that dropping the 2-trial requirement reflects modern advances that have made drug research increasingly precise and scientific. In this setting, over-reliance on 2 trials no longer makes sense, they write. In 2026, there are powerful alternative ways to feel assured that our products help people live longer or better than requiring manufacturers to test them yet again. The FDA officials predicted the shift would lead to a surge in drug development. Dr. Janet Woodcock, the FDA's former drug director, said the change makes sense and reflects the FDA's decades-long move toward relying on 1 trial, combined with supporting evidence for various life-threatening diseases, including cancer. The scientific point is well taken that as we move toward greater understanding of biology and disease, we don't need to do 2 trials all the time, said Woodcock, who led the FDA's drug center for about 20 years before retiring in 2024. The 2-study standard for drugs dates to the early 1960s, when Congress passed a law requiring the FDA to review data from adequate and well-controlled investigations before clearing new medications. For decades, the agency interpreted that requirement as meaning at least 2 studies, preferably with a large number of patients and significant follow-up time. The reason for requiring the 2nd study was to confirm that the 1st trial's results weren't a fluke and could be reproduced. But beginning in the 1990s, the FDA increasingly began accepting single studies for the approval of treatments for rare or fatal diseases that companies often struggle to test in large numbers of patients. Over the last 5 years, roughly 6%, 60% of first-of-a-kind drugs approved each year have been cleared based on a single study. The shift reflects laws passed by Congress that directed regulators to be more flexible when reviewing drugs for serious or hard-to-treat conditions. Woodcock said the new policy announced Wednesday will mainly impact drugs for common diseases that previously weren't eligible for reduced testing standards. It's not the cancers and the rare diseases that will be affected by this, she noted. The agency has been approving those on a single trial already. The latest approach from FDA leadership contrasts with the agency's recent actions on vaccines, gene therapies, and other treatments. Last week, the FDA's vaccine division, headed by Prasad, refused to accept Moderna's application for a new mRNA flu shot, saying its clinical trial was insufficient. Then on Wednesday, the agency reversed course, saying it would review the vaccine after Moderna agreed to conduct an additional study in older people. Separately, Prasad has rejected a string of experimental gene therapies and biotech drugs, citing the need for additional studies or more definitive evidence. The trend has weighed on the stocks of many biotech companies and clashed with Macquarie's public statements promoting the speed and flexibility of the FDA's reviews. Woodcock said the drug industry will have to wait and see whether the FDA's approach to promising experimental therapies changes. Implementation will be everything, she said, since the agency's approach is unclear and the industry is already baffled. I don't think this adds any illumination.